It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll look at a proposal to eliminate or drastically reduce the job of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, which has come under a lot of scrutiny in recent years.
First, polls have closed in Scotland today in what's expected to be a very close vote on independence from the United Kingdom. So we brought in our resident Central Time historian for a view from the side of the Atlantic and a look at how Scottish independence compares to secession movements in the United States.
Jonathan Pollock is with us. He's a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. He joins us each month for some historical perspective on the latest news. John, welcome back.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be here.
Well, before we get into American history, it seems like this Scottish thing has captured a lot of people's imagination. Do you think some people have a rooting interest here in the U.S. on what happens today?
I think definitely. I mean, I think there are a bunch of different rooting interests. That the most obvious one is that I think we often forget the Scottish contributions to U.S. history, that there's a long, long, long Scottish presence in British North America and the United States to follow. And often, I mean, you know, especially in Wisconsin, there's plenty of people of Scottish descent, but we often think about German ethnicity in Wisconsin and Norwegian and other Scandinavians and so forth. And this is kind of for Americans who are of Scottish descent. And I think even for Americans who kind of take that for granted and don't think about it a whole lot, it's really their moment in the sun. They're really identifying with this. They're interested. They're kind of, thinking about their ties back to their home country. They're looking at Scottish independence and American independence in some kind of context. And also, I think Americans really love elections. I mean, the way we cover elections, where it's a horse race, you know, when it's election season, or if you're living in a state when primary time is coming up, even people who aren't, you know, always talking politics, or all of a sudden they're interested. There's that kind of horse race aspect. And in Scotland, where oftentimes Americans don't take a great deal of interest in even like Canadian or Mexican elections that are relatively close by, in Scotland, the differences are really stark. You know, Scotland's going to remain part of the UK, or it's going to be an independent country in some fashion. There's a lot of big questions there, a lot of potential. And so, yeah, I think Americans are really following this election.
Do you think that Americans are really vested stakeholders in the outcome? Or is it more like you said, you know, like watching a really good high stakes football game where, you know, no matter what happens, you'll go, and then you'll go and you'll have a drink or something, relax and forget about
have
it.
Have a belt
for the
of scotch. Yeah. So, I think it's more kind of the latter. I mean, given that we're not totally sure what would happen if Scotland actually votes yes and becomes independent, and what the nature of that independence will be, and what that means for the pound as the currency and its membership in the European Union and so forth, that I think the deeper ramifications people aren't necessarily thinking about, or we just don't know what the story is. But yeah, as a fun event to follow, the football game metaphor is a good one. In a lot of ways, I think it's like how, when I've met people who are living in the United States during an election year here, where they get kind of caught up in it and they'll ask about, well, what do you think of this candidate and why do people support that candidate and so forth? Even though at the end of it all, they're going back to their home country and relations probably aren't going to change all that much. It's still it's a fun thing to follow. And again, because the questions are so – because it's such an obvious yes-no, that you don't have to have a deep understanding of the Labour Party or the Conservative Party and what they stand for to follow along.
Well, and part of what makes it fun is that, hey, the map could change. Sorry, cartographers out there. But nobody's going to die over this.
This is true, yeah. And unlike other secessionist movements we've talked about in the past, and unlike many of them throughout European and world history, there really isn't a war that's going on underneath. It's not as though there have been skirmishes along the border of England and Scotland, and or that British businesses have been attacked in Edinburgh and so forth. It's a very peaceful kind of split, which also makes it all the more interesting that we're accustomed in the U.S. I think, of course, the Civil War comes to mind for people, where it's a deep-seated and bloody issue in a bunch of ways. And then the idea of, all right, so it's a movement to secede that's supremely peaceful. What's up with that? We want to learn more about it and find out what's going on.
Are there other instances that follow that Scottish model where it's incredibly civil? You know, we'd really rather not be part of your country anymore. Thank you very much, and we'd like to vote instead of something that's a lot more bloody.
Yeah, I mean, well, certainly, definitely in the United States, there isn't really a case of that. I mean, we could look at like the composition of individual states, which is sort of akin to nations and sort of not. you know, it seems to me like Rob, when we were corresponding about this, you mentioned West Virginia becoming a state, breaking away from Virginia in 1863. And so that was kind of the middle of the Civil War. I mean, that in some ways, you know, there wasn't a renewed offensive into West Virginia to take back Charleston and bring it back into Virginia or anything. But at the same time, there was a war on. And so it was pretty supremely bloody in context. Veronica, I'd say no. I'd say for the most part, secession is usually a, you know, it's either a byproduct of a war or a revolution. It's usually, it precipitates one in some cases. As you were formulating the question, I was kind of racking my brain, my late afternoon brain here, and trying to think of times where countries have just kind of voted to opt out. And I'm not really thinking of it. I mean, I guess the one thing I can think of is if we look at, if I remember this correctly, and callers keep me honest on this one, if we're thinking about like the independence of Slovenia in the late 1980s, there were certainly plenty of wars going on as Yugoslavia was breaking up, and it's become kind of a metaphor for what can happen when a country breaks into smaller parts. But to the best of my knowledge, Slovenia didn't have anywhere near the same kind of conflict that Bosnia or Croatia or Serbia or Kosovo had during that time. Generally, secession is a really heated and bloody issue.
Well, let's get to a caller at 800-642-1234. Steve is on the line in Stoughton. Steve, hi. Steve, are you there? Steve, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Hi, you're on the air now. What did you want to bring up?
Hey, I hope the yes vote goes through for the Scottish folk. We went to visit Scotland last year and spent a lot of time in the Highlands and the Outer Hebrides. The sentiment was, you know, separate. They wanted to be separate. They wanted the yes vote to pass. But it was interesting, they felt a connection to us, and several folks referred to us as their American cousins. We were both in the same situation, trying to, you know, at some point in history, get away from British rule. I thought that was interesting.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. In a way, the United States seceded, or it was a colony, so I don't know if it counts the same. Canada, Australia, in similar ways, devolved power down to them. He has a rooting interest. He's a pro-Scotland independence there. Thoughts on what he had to say, John?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my question I'm curious about what – I mean, in some ways, I guess the issues are somewhat similar. I mean, the issue of the relationship between the central government – that the central government in London doesn't represent the people in the area that's looking to secede – I'd say that's definitely a close correspondence between between Scottish independence and U.S. independence over 200 years ago. But I think where the difference is that the tension that existed was much less. I mean, the American Revolution came on the heels of years of kind of guerrilla warfare of various types, of increasingly inflammatory language about the language about the British. And also, I think as a result of less integration between the colonies and England, that there's an ocean separating them. And in the 1700s, that's really a huge, huge amount of space in a whole bunch of ways, where Scotland's been intimately tied to England since before the American Revolution, since 1707. I'd be curious to hear if more callers have ideas about, if other callers have visited Scotland, what exactly are the specific issues driving the independence vote?
Well, let's take another caller now, and we're going to go next to Dennis in Ripon. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. As I recall, I believe it was in the mid to late 60s, wasn't there talk about the UP and northern Wisconsin trying to become the state of Superior?
Okay, interesting, Dennis. Yeah, I think I've caught wind of that before. Tell us about
that,
John.
Is one that Rob and I kicked this one around also, and I looked into it. And I mean, certainly from a Michigan perspective, and particularly before the Mackinac Bridge was constructed, the UP really was kind of like a separate state. It was remote from Lansing and from the major industrial cities of southern Michigan and Detroit and Flint and Kalamazoo and Grand Rapids and such. And so as a result, the UP was a very different place. It had a very different set of interests than downstate Michigan and so forth. But my sense of the Superior campaign was, on the one hand, it was kind of rooted in state tax policies and policies that favored like the auto industry, which is basically absent in the UP. There's not a whole lot of auto up there. It was mining centered and so forth. And there's not really mining in southern Michigan to any great extent. But that beyond that general economic picture, it was kind of an absurd thing. It was kind of a way to, you know, something to put on a T-shirt. It was a way for people of taking their like regional pride and putting something behind it. even though most people said that, you know, the movement had nowhere near the kind of success, even getting on the ballot, as we're seeing in Scotland.
But in that case, maybe it would have the effect of drawing attention and saying, hey, you guys down there in the South got to pay attention to us. Whereas, and even in this Scottish case, the leaders of all British parties, main British parties, have said, even if you guys fail, we're going to try to devolve some more power to you.
Well, and this is true. And I think that's one of the characteristics of secession movements in the U.S., even post-Civil War, when there haven't been armed efforts for states to break away or states to break up into smaller parts and so forth, that secession is definitely a way of really putting an issue on the table. And if people are getting to that point, it's a sign they feel their interests aren't being met, whether in their state capital or in Washington.
We're talking right now with Jonathan Pollock, history instructor at Madison Area Technical College and resident Central Time historian. We're looking at today's independence vote in Scotland and how it compares and contrasts with secession movements in American history.
And we want to hear from you. Were you rooting one way or another on the Scottish vote? Is it a story you've been following? And are there lessons here for the rest of the world, maybe for us in the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
We continue our conversation about the history of secession movements in the United States as Scotland votes today on whether or not to leave the United Kingdom.
And you can join the conversation with your thoughts on what's going on in Scotland. Are you hoping for an outcome one way or another? And do you think that there are lessons, comparisons, contrasts with things that have happened in American history? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John, before we get back to the calls, I mean, obviously the biggie, we've touched on it when it comes to secession here, the secession movements leading up to the Civil War. History, GRE, essay question for you, John, compare and contrast.
Yeah, well, this is why I bombed the GREs. seriously, I bombed the GREs. No, I mean, that's huge. I mean, it's almost you can't compare the two of them. I mean, if we're talking about the Civil War in the United States, we can find all kinds of violent skirmishes between the two sides where, you know, people are killed for or beaten severely for criticizing the South or so forth. And Scotland, as we've been saying, the whole debate, I mean, on the one hand, is much more long lasting that, you know, we could look at the big picture and go back 300 years and look at what happened to Scots Gaelic, to the language of Scotland, as Scotland became increasingly absorbed into the UK. And you can find, you know, examples of people holding on to their culture and rebellion and so forth in times where the British government is more or less concerned with suppressing Scots Gaelic language and culture and so forth, and other times where they celebrate it. But I think it's a much longer term for one thing. And again, there's just a lot less violence involved. Even the rhetoric, you know, the rhetoric about North and South in the U.S. going back to the early 19th century is really charged and angry and accusatory in the way that we're just not, at least I'm not seeing in the coverage of the Scottish election, that it's a much more kind of it's more of kind of an idealistic thing. It's just kind of like, oh, hey, why not? Let's try it out. Maybe we're just tired of, you know, it's partly disillusionment with present day British politics. But what I think is interesting about it is that, you know, disillusionment with politics in the pre-Civil War era was like South Carolina saying, OK, we're not going to let U.S. customs agents collect taxes in Charleston Harbor. We're going to prevent them from being there. And Congress had to intervene and so forth. And in Scotland, it's like, yeah, we really don't like the Tory government down there in London, so we're going to form our own country. You know, it's a very different level of intensity, I think.
And before we get back to our callers, I want to ask you, you know, no matter what happens tomorrow morning, do you see this as sort of simmering away on the back burner no matter what?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the pro-independence side, the yes vote in Scotland has really made enough of a case for it. It's become a global issue now. It's become something that, you know, people far afield from Scotland are watching and curious to see what's going to happen. And so as a result, I think when Scottish interests or Scottish party, Scottish National Party, in conjunction with other parties that are opposed to the leadership in England, they'll be able to make a stronger case for it. They'll be able to kind of point to this, even if they lose the election, as, oh, well, you know, so the yes vote lost by 5 points last time. If you keep this up, we'll call another election and maybe this time we'll win. So it kind of, I think it serves as a terrific bargaining chip for Scottish interests, regardless of the outcome.
go back to our callers now. We've got Rod on the line in Madison. Rod, hi.
Hi. My comment is, when thinking of other peaceful secessionist movements, we can't forget one of the biggest ethnic groups we have in Wisconsin are the Norwegians. And Norway's separation from Sweden at the beginning of the 20th century was peaceful, and they had an arrangement very similar to the UK, where they had some local independence, but they were caught up in nationalism and got their freedom from Sweden.
Rod, thanks a lot for the call. I will admit to not being as up on the history there as I should be, but maybe an example that we can look to here.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent example. So it shows that it is possible. It shows that countries that have different traditions and a different national history can split apart without a revolution. That's a great first step, and I'm eager to hear more.
And I'm going to ask you this next one. I don't know if this is in your wheelhouse or not, John, but a listener wants to know, how well is Scotland set up to be an independent country? Strong enough economy? Can it stand on its own?
Wow. It's a great question. I have to admit I'm not an expert on contemporary Scotland, but from what I've been reading, we're not really sure. I mean, I think one of the big questions comes down to what's Scotland's currency? You know, does Scotland stay on the pound? Do they adopt the euro? Once you look at the currency question, that's going to have a big part in the Scottish economy, in an independent Scottish economy. What's going to happen to banking? What's going to happen to British industry? You know, there are all kinds of threats about that you're starting to hear from the anti-independence forces about the dire things that will face Scotland once it becomes independent. So that's where it's really hard to tell. I mean, we know that Scotland's present prosperity, it's a fairly prosperous area in present, comes from North Sea oil. We don't know how much oil is down there. We don't know how long that'll hold out. For companies like BP doing business in Scotland, how much money would BP share with an independent Scotland? At what point would Scotland force BP to pay higher taxes and so forth? It's what ifs on top of what ifs, so we're not really sure. I mean, yeah, we know Scotland's not destitute. We know England's not destitute. That Scotland would immediately, the economy would crash instantly if they declared independence. Again, the moderate nature of this movement, peaceful nature of this movement doesn't, you know, lead us to see like squads of Scottish police going in and seizing the means of production or anything in that line. But still, anything more specific than that is really hard to foresee.
Go back to our callers with Aaron in Reedstown now. Aaron, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to bring up, and I don't know if the historian here, your guest, knows of this, but the history of Vermont and how they had remained their own republic all the way up till 1792 and did not join the rest of the Union until they signed, if I remember correctly, signed what was called the Moscow Covenant with George Washington that deemed that Vermont will join the Union, but is allowed to secede at any time it wanted to if the Union did not live up to its moral standards.
Yeah, so right. I knew that the Vermont was independent, was an independent republic from roughly 1777 to 1792. So 15 years of Vermont independence. During that time, it was fairly thinly settled. The nature of its government was pretty small. And I know that Vermont has actually been, there's been voices about Vermont seceding from the U.S. or parts of the Northeast Kingdom, the northeastern part of Vermont seceding from the rest of Vermont, and citing documents from back in the brief era of Vermontese independence. I don't know the exact substance of it. I don't know the exact clause, whether that's there or not. That sounds logical. But I think in practice, after people have kind of voiced them at a town hall meeting in Vermont, and they've been disillusioned with what's going on in Washington or disillusioned with what's happening in Burlington, that people have kind of walked out of there and said, yeah, this is great. This is time to secede. And by the time they read about it in the papers the next morning or talk about it in the light of the day, they're just like, God, that's a crazy idea. That's not going to work. And it kind of dies down. Again, it becomes kind of a more concrete way, as we've said before, of establishing Vermont as having this kind of unique and quirky set of qualities to it that distinguish it from New York or New Hampshire, but not actually moving towards serious succession.
And John, just briefly, in our last moments, you know, again, no matter what happens tomorrow, will the fact of this and the fact that it has become such a cause of interest lend any sort of oomph to closet secessionists out there, no matter where they are, saying, hey, if Scott Lincoln can get this out there, maybe we can.
That's a great question. Yeah. And I guess, you know, so if the vote goes yes, and if Scotland secedes, and whether that is a peaceful transition of power or whether it causes economic chaos or something, then, yeah, the lessons of that, the eventual outcome of Scottish independence, if it happens, would definitely be a signal to people who are pondering other movements, and how well that goes will determine what the nature of that signal is.
John, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Pollock, history instructor at Madison Area Technical College and resident historian here at Central Time.
Coming up, we'll look at a proposal from a Wisconsin congressman to more or less eliminate the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, spurred in part by botched operations in Milwaukee.